The House Committee on Judiciary, today is February 2nd. We're going to have public hearings, kind of out of order. I'm going to hear 2316 and 2317 with one witness, and then we'll go back and start over again. But I'd like to call Chief Justice Dumunis, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Paul Dumunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you for allowing me to testify first and run off to my other duties. I want to thank you for scheduling the hearing on these two judicial department bills, House Bill 2316 and House Bill 2317. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you early in the session. As I indicated, I have a very limited role here this afternoon. I'd like to briefly introduce these two bills and then let you hear from people who know most about them. Let me begin with House Bill 2316. House Bill 2316 would authorize 13 new circuit court judge positions in the statutes. It is the result of a committee jointly sponsored by the Judicial Department and the Oregon State Bar. You should have before you or about to receive a copy of their report explaining their methodology and their recommendations. I'd like to publicly thank the Oregon State Bar for participating in this effort, especially Mr. Tim Willis, who's here, who chaired that committee very ably and from whom you will hear later. I would also like to acknowledge and thank two of your colleagues who served on the work group, Representatives Cliff Benz and Representative Nancy Nathanson. As you'll hear in greater detail, we've requested this bill to allow us to meet the workload needs of Oregon Circuit Courts. A wide variety of issues influence our trial court workload. Some arise from increases in the state's population. Others arise from decisions that this body makes, like the laws that establish unions or causes of action, laws that establish timelines and procedures for court action. Significantly in areas of juvenile law, in dependency issues, issues regarding children and families, we have timelines and court actions that we have to take, all of which have an effect on the courts and have to do with allocating our resources. And when you look at what happens with state troopers, prosecutors, and defense counsels, all of these things, as documented in the report, have an effect. Regardless of the sources of that workload, we'd ask that you give us the opportunity to seek in our budget discussions the resources we need to fulfill the responsibilities that Oregon's Constitution and statutes entrust to us. Having stood before hundreds of juries in 15 years before I went on the bench, I'm keenly aware of what might be going through your head right now. Chief Justice is here asking for 13 new court positions in a budget situation that may be unprecedented. Obviously, it's a very difficult time to do that, but I would like to have you think of it as it might be the worst of times, but it might be also be the best of times. It might be the best of times using this as a mechanism for us to have a further very robust discussion about what is the role of the courts, what resources do we need for the courts to carry out their constitutional and statutory mandates. So I offer that in that spirit. And I hope that you will approve this bill and send it to the Ways and Means Committee so that we can have a robust discussion regarding judicial resources and priorities. Let me switch now to touch briefly on House Bill 2317, which would allow the Judicial Department to collect court-ordered financial obligations by intercepting some winnings from the Oregon State Lottery. As I mentioned in my State of the Court speech, which I have provided to all of you in another communication, the Oregon Judicial Branch is one of the largest revenue-raising entities in state government. We are on track this biennium to collect a record $287 million. Those collections go to individual victims of crime as restitution, to the state criminal fines and assessment account to fund public safety training and services, and to the general funds of the state, cities, and counties. House Bill 2317 is part, and I would repeat this, is part of a larger effort and a larger thought that I have about how to ensure that court-ordered financial obligations are enforced. And more than anything, it's a court integrity bill, part of our larger thoughts about making sure that court-ordered obligations are honored. And also, it's part of a larger discussion and concept that I hope to have with all of you in bringing revenue solutions and resources to the table in part of these very difficult budget times. So I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to introduce these two bills, and I hope that you will take the necessary action with regard to them. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have questions for Chief Justice?
Mr. Chair, Chief, first, I just want to thank you for coming in, and indeed, I'm honored by your presence, or I think we all are, and also state that, at least speaking only for myself and hopefully many of the other members of the committee, the number of judges and actually having access to courts, both civil and criminal, is absolutely a business issue. It is absolutely a conditioned precedent for an economic recovery in this state. That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Barton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Chair.
We are close the public hearing on House Bill 2316-2317 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2304. Chris Hawley, please. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hall. I'm a partner with Perkins Coie. I'm also, as your Friday bell repeat, just to keep it on the record here for this one, I'm a member of the executive committee of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm also the chair of its legislative committee. And I do represent positions of the business law section, which has recommended some changes to Oregon's short form. Mainly, House Bill 2304 removes an unnecessary burden on completing a short form merger in Oregon, while I believe not harming minority shareholders. The bill simply requires notice of a short form merger within 10 days after it occurs rather than the current 30 days before it occurs. Just to make sure we understand what short-form merger is, it's just a streamlined way for 90% plus parent to buy a subsidiary. So it allows a 90% shareholder to buy out the minority holder simply by giving them notice that it's doing it and paying them. The shareholders have no right to have a say in the matter. And the idea is just at some point, say like owning 90% or more of shares, a parent should be able to just complete its acquisition of a subsidiary. But to protect minority shareholders, Oregon, like every state, gives the shareholders a right to judicial appraisal for the fair value of shares. So the parent can't just give anything it wants to it. If the shareholders think it's unacceptable, the price, then they can get a court to and go through an appraisal process for the fair value. So currently, Oregon law requires a 30 days advance waiting period. We believe this waiting period is inconsistent with the administrative ease of the short-form merger statute and may unduly delay the transaction. This, like anything that, there's always a catalyst to stimulate change when we're addressing this. So, for example, if you have a tender offer or where a company goes out and buys 90% or more of the shares of a company, and this a lot of times comes up with public companies where you just can't, it's almost impossible to get 100%, either because people don't respond or sometimes they, maybe not like the price or maybe hold out. The current law would say you need to go and pay for that 90% in your shares, then you need to sit there with minority shareholders for a month, for 30 days, and then you have the unilateral right to buy the rest of it. And what this change does says we could just do it all at once, and you don't have to sit out there for that period of time. Unlike Oregon statute, the Bottle Business Corporation Act, upon which, as we talked about on Friday, the Oregon statute is based, doesn't require advance notice for short-form mergers, so this proposal would put us in line with the Oregon Let's see, the Model Business Corporation Act, which just requires a 10 days notice after. You know, again, shareholders who believe they're harmed, their judicial appraisal, they can sue all after the transaction. It's just this administrative price piece of the pre-notice that we're addressing here. And there's a few other conforming changes in the statutes just to make sure the appraisal rights still are available for shareholders, and then just correcting a reference in the statute. So the business law, in conclusion, the business law section believes these are changes are necessary for efficient time inclusive short form mergers, and recommends that the Judiciary Committee move House Bill 2304 to the full House with a due pass vote. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, also for the record, I just want to acknowledge, although not an economic conflict, Chris is my colleague at Perkins Coie and also my friend. I have a few questions. First of all, we can ignore the irony of the fact that on Friday you wanted us to go from the Model Business Code to Delaware, and I was skeptical, and now you're trying to get us to the Model Business Corporations Act, and now I'm again skeptical. But I have two issues with this, and I'm hoping you can set me at ease. Number one is, well, the 30-day waiting period, I believe, and I think there might have been some disagreement, does give potential dissenters a right to, for example, enjoin the proceeding. And I believe the standard to do so would be very difficult. It would be the same as an ex post rescission, I would think. It would be fraud or some violation of the statute. I'm concerned about taking away that opportunity, because even though, first of all, it's a very difficult burden to me to actually get an injunction, but it would be almost impossible for a court to meaningfully rescind a short-term merger. So that's problem number one. Let's start with that, and then I'll come back for question number two, if that's all right.
Sure. Chair, Representative Barton, first, and just I would like to comment on the Delaware to the Model Act. And as Andy Merrill pointed out on Friday, we weren't pushing to go to Delaware law for that. In response to the question is we should have a statute that's the best for Oregon and the best statute. The Model Act is the act that we base it on, and that would be the preference to do and to look at. And frankly, at one point I had the whole Model Act compared to our act, so we can go through and start saying where have we not kept up over the years. And the next thing, we'll get to the next bill, one where we didn't keep up, where they clearly fixed something and we didn't. So just for that. On the enjoining, that to me is probably the only thing I could think of that you would say is taken away from a shareholder is their ability to enjoin the our potential, if you're seeking an injunction anyways, to stop this merger from happening. The thing is, you only get an injunction if there's not an economic remedy for it. So first thing we have to conceive of, how can there not be an economic remedy? In other words, stop it because somehow by not having the merger go forward, you can't figure out a price for that. They have no right, though. At the end of the day, they have no right to stop it. The law is clear. The law is clear that you file the merger, you give them notice, you file the papers, and it's done. You don't need their vote. You don't need their consent. You don't need to send them anything that describes the whole thing. You just need to send them the plan that you're going to do it. That's it. And so it's pretty, even though the ability to enjoin is there in theory, I think truly is only in theory. And to have something that's administratively difficult for a possibility you can't see doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So are you not, has it never happened? Are you unaware of any attempt to enjoin a short form merger in the state or any other jurisdiction?
Chair Buckett, I've not done a survey in any jurisdiction to see if it's ever happened.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So that was concern number one, because we are very much taking away at least an ability to enjoin ex ante this kind of short-term merger. My second concern, and I'm not particularly familiar with this procedure, but in order for a dissenter, then this is now we're talking about ex post relief after the short-term merger. Let's pretend they don't like the amount in court that they're receiving for their minority rights. And minority shares, they would go to an appraisal process. Now, in order to basically avail themselves of this remedy, I believe they have to, at the time of the board meeting, they actually have to provide notice to the company, if I'm not mistaken, to, I think it's, according to my reading, under, to avail themselves of the remedies under ORS 60591 at SEC. I'm wondering if you can speak to that. Is this going to in any way impinge their ability to avail themselves of appraisal?
Chair, Representative Barton, it will not. It will not impede it in any way. I mean, I'll put aside a second the our appraisal statute needs a little fixing as well because it doesn't recognize a few things in our law that is a little bit problematic. But it doesn't because if you go through the appraisal statute, you know, they need to have, a person needs to have notice of the, that they have the appraisal rights, right? So there's a, typically the way the process flows, the board, you know, you have a shareholder action and they need to decide something at that point, and then they have the action, then after the action, which is the merger, then there's another notice and period. So what happened in this case is you would have the short form merger, you would send notice, and that notice is going to trigger them being able to respond with an appraisal, request for an appraisal. It makes no change whatsoever to current law in that regard. Because you got to remember, in the short form merger, you never have a shareholder vote for this, and that's usually the that's usually the starting point of the appraisal process. This is not required, so again, there's no change.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a follow-up, clarifying question. The theoretical possibility that exists to bring an injunction before, under the current law, would that be to seek any remedy other than basically saying they've undervalued my shares, please appraise them? Is there any other reason why a person would try to enjoin a short-form merger?
Personally, I couldn't think of any. Part of being, you know, our process for this being a position of the bars, I'm supposed to identify downsides as well, and then we share that with other sections of the bar and, you know, talk to some folks from the Trialers Association about this, you know, this aspect. And so, you know, we really couldn't think of, you know, really what they could get other than the damages. You know, why? I mean, I don't know. I just can't conceive it. So,
all right. Thanks.
Chair, actually, I do have a couple.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 30-day waiting period that currently exists, I suppose I have two questions with your permission, Mr. Chair. Number one, first of all, why do we have it in Oregon? If it's truly irrelevant, if there's truly no possibility to get an injunction, why is it there? And second of all, second question is it really so onerous for corporations? If it serves absolutely no purpose, fine. But assuming it does serve some kind of purpose, is it really that burdensome to make a corporation wait 30 days before enacting a short-form merger?
Chair Representative Barton, the answer to your questions, first, why is it there? Frankly, I don't know. I spent some time thinking of that for the very reason that I just discussed, that we need to be thinking about all the downsides as well and then presenting the downsides and being prepared to talk about those, because this is supposed to be an improvement to our act and not something that we just, you know, we want for the sake of wanting it for anything other than improvement. But I haven't been able to figure out one. So the second question, so I'm sorry if that's not very helpful. The second question, is it so onerous? The answer is, it's not the end of the world. If it was, we probably would have been here before now. There's a workaround that what's triggered this last summer that came up. They worked around it. It was a little, you know, they didn't feel that good about working around it, and it took a workaround, but it's not, you know, like the world's going to stop. And this really is, with the, frankly, I believe, no downside, just a cleanup and make it just easier and not have to do workarounds or otherwise, you know, deal with something that just causes a little more burden that's unnecessary.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Chris, I'm trying to figure out where this part of the statute came from. Did you look to the legislative history? Do we know when it was put into the ORS?
We try to look at, if you know, and Chair Representative Shields, legislative history is a little tough in Oregon.
It might require going to the library.
You know, I couldn't find a library. I wasn't prepared to answer that question. legislative history is a little tough in Oregon. You can look through. We do have, if you recall, Andy Morrow, who is here with us on Friday, who's part of our committees. You know, he was one of the people who put in the current statute and the model. So I was looking for, I always looked to him of, you know, history and where things came from, and didn't really have a lot of help here. And we looked back at the history without really finding anything that was helpful. I mean, as you'll find with a lot of the statutes that we have, there's a lot of wholesale adoption from some proposal. Like, so say the Model Act comes out saying here's this, and so we adopt that without really spending a lot of time discussing all of the details of it, and there it is. And some of them we find, you know, the Model Act, and a year later makes a change, or 2 years later makes a change, when they figure out, well, this didn't quite work the way we wanted to. And of course, we aren't all that good, frankly. We should be better, but we're not that good of keeping up on the Model Act and saying, okay, they changed it because they realized it didn't make sense, and then we're changing it. So I don't really have a good answer to your question either.
So we don't really know what era this might have come from.
Oh, this would have been around, well, I shouldn't speculate. It's been around for a while, though, but I put it that way.
Further questions?
One
more. Okay.
Mr. Hall, this is just sort of a general comment. These sort of series of little dribbles of changes to the corporations code, or the provisions in statute dealing with corporations and the shareholders. Individually, they may not seem like, I don't want to say this, that they are an assault on minority shareholders' rights, but you start taking them in their totality. So I guess my question to you is, are we anticipating a series of these beyond where we're at right now?
Chair Representative Steigler, this is only for, at least for this, because this is the next one after this, because you know I'm up for one more. That's it for me. So unless someone asks me on something else, but we have no more proposals to come, so there's none other in the, if you're trying to get the big scheme of, let's look at the big picture of what's going on.
It would just be a little concerning.
And we don't, I mean, as you probably can guess, we don't feel it as an assault on minority shareholder rights. That's not... Frankly, with some of these statutes that we have, I can, you know, go through a whole set of things that I think are more difficult, but we choose not to because they were controversial. This, frankly, I didn't think was controversial at all. I thought it was just more of a cleanup.
Sorry about that, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you.
Wasn't commentary from that.
No further questions. Okay, thank you, Mr. Hall.
He's going through you.
Mr. Chair, things are a lot clearer now.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2304 and open a work session on House Bill 2304. Be everybody satisfied, and if we pass this unanimously, I would like to move this one to the consent calendar. Move it through if there's any question.
I just want to let you know, Mr. Chair, I'm not quite yet comfortable with this, so I probably will be a no vote.
Okay. Then it will not go to the consent calendar then. Thank you, Representative Shields. I would accept a motion to approve House Bill 2304 and send it to the floor with a due pass. Recommendation. Representative Garrett, so moves. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barger?
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to work this bill tomorrow?
Yes, we can.
I would appreciate a night to think
about
this.
Okay.
With your permission, I can vote if
no,
it's your preference.
Motion withdrawn.
Apologies, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What's the work session on House Bill 2304? Okay, and the bill will be on the hearing to be worked tomorrow, so we have notice for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next we'll open a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2305.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill will amend current statute by requiring two or more classes of stock affected by an amendment to vote as a single group. It conforms ORS 60.441 with the Model Business Corporations Act, and it erases the disparity between series and class voting.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hall, please.
It's
my pleasure to be back.
Is your tongue glued to your cheeks?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hall, partner with Perkins Coie, member of the Executive Committee of the State Bar, Business Law Section, Chair of the Legislative Section. The Business Law Section, again, has recommended changes to Oregon's class voting statute. House Bill 2305, what I would call, corrects an unintended problem with current law regarding shareholder class voting. It makes a correction to the Model Business Corporation Act, eliminates some unnecessary and frequently unintended shareholder rights to veto certain transactions, but at the same time, we're being more permissive, I think, in allowing the corporation shareholders to acquire individual votes. So currently, Oregon law requires different voting groups to vote separately on certain amendments to the Articles of Corporation. And this is meant to provide protection to specific groups against amendments that be burdensome on those particular groups. And the groups are defined really by series and class, and I don't know if I should probably take a second to describe what a series and class is, because it may not be that intuitive to everybody. Well, just real quick. So say a typical corporation may have, say, three classes of stock, say common A, voting stock, common B, non-voting stock, and preferred stock. Those would be three classes. A series is simply just a subclass with one of those classes. So you'd have series A, preferred stock, series B, preferred stock, series C, preferred stock, which is typically what's given in venture capital financing. So now we're saying the main rule that classes and series vote separately on certain matters that would affect, certain matters that are enumerated in the statute. Oregon law provides that if amendment would affect two or more series in the same or substantially similar way, the series vote together as a group. In other words, if the amendment doesn't have a particular effect on a particular group, then that group shouldn't have a separate vote. And you can view the separate vote as kind of a veto right, saying, I don't want that to pass. But if they're the same as everybody else, then they should vote together with everybody else. So the rule requiring similarly affected series to vote together does not provide similarly affected classes to vote together, even if they are likewise substantially similar affected by every other class. So, for example, if you have an emerging growth Oregon company and they require preferred stock financing, which is the typical financing a Oregon emerging growth company would have, they would need to have the consent of all series of preferred stock, all the venture capital funding rounds before them, together as a group, unless there's something negotiated separately, in all classes of common stock, regardless of whether there's voting rights within those common stocks. So specifically, situations have arisen where a company wants to add preferred stock, but the non-voting class of common stock that's given to employees as equity compensation have a right to basically veto the transaction. So the company and the investors, frankly, get very surprised when you say, okay, let's put in this new round of financing that we need. Oh, and oh, by the way, your assistants, the day-to-day people that you've given stock to so they can participate in the economic growth of the company, well, you have to go convince them that this is the right thing to do, even though this is not something they know anything about. So Oregon companies, by creating a non-voting class of stock that's really meant for economic participation to companies' growth without shifting control of the company, inadvertently create a blocking class of stock, which is the opposite of their intents. And coincidentally, though, the current law also mandates that series vote together. So if a series wants a separate vote, saying, I'm putting money, I don't care if I'm affected the same as them, I want my own vote, the law mandates that they vote together with everybody else. I think people, causing question whether you really can negotiate separate voting rights. So House Bill 2305 resolves these problems by providing that series and classes of stock that are substantially similarly treated vote together and allows companies and the boards to have separate voting groups nonetheless if they want to. So the business law section believes these changes are consistent with the protection of shareholders of certain series and classes, but corrects some unintended consequences. And we hope that the House does send, or the committee sends this full House with the due pass vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Hall. Excuse me. At the end of the changes in subsection 3, you've tacked on the unless the articles of incorporation provide or the board of directors requires otherwise. I'm just curious as to sort of why the opt-out ability there. Is it to retroactively bring in, basically so that existing situations aren't out of compliance, or is it to give the potential for articles to be drawn up otherwise? And then that begs the question to me of then why the changes you're proposing.
And go back another step just to address from Representative Shields in the last question. This one I do know the history a bit better on, which is we adopted the Model Act as it was, 80s, 90s, I don't really know when it was. I think this provision was in the 90s. And they, within a year, changed theirs and said that they're, because they just had the series like this. So they made change of theirs within a year, basically saying we kind of missed this and here's the fix. So we are adopting what the Model Act has, which is one, to add classes, and two, to add the unless the article is the provision that you asked specifically about. So this is just it comes from there. That is meant to say, even if the statute says if a series or class is similarly treated and therefore must vote together, the board, or if the investors who put the money in negotiated a separate voting right, they still get it. So this is being more pervasive, saying, hey, let's not look at the statute and say you have to vote together. This is to say, maybe the default is you vote together, but if I'm a shareholder, I put in money and I want to vote separately, I don't care what the statute says, I get that vote separately. So this is supposed to be more to help the shareholders, investors who want a separate voting right. Does that help, or is that funny?
It would seem to me that in actuality what we're doing is adding another classification in there. And I understand the classes and series. It almost appears like it was inadvertent that got left out of the descriptive language there. But then to have the opt-out language to me sort of seems to, I don't know, to me it seems to sort of defeat the purpose of putting it in there in the first place. So.
Yeah, well, I think what really would happen is, these companies form the non-voting class of stock, and of course in non-voting they don't give them a voting right. That's the whole concept. And so this would make the voting non-voting common stock and the voting common stock
vote together.
Putting preferred stock, they're both the same. It's just an economic. They're both one layer down economically. They're the same, so they vote together. There's no reason why they should be separately voting on that. It just doesn't make any sense.
And I get that part. I just don't get why.
So say you're doing your series, your venture capital financing specifically. So you're in series, you have your series A done, your series B done. Now you're in your series C, and this is when the big money comes in. So I'm saying, I'm putting a bunch of money in. You know what? I don't really like the fact that if you want to do another layer series, that I have to vote with the A and the B and the C were grouped together. That means it's not my decision. I have to decide with the A and B. So I'm going to negotiate a separate right to Series C. So I get a right no matter what to vote on any changes to the articles, period. Don't care about what the statute says. Well, we want to be able to give them that. And frankly, in the reality of it is people do give them that now, and people ignore the...
So it essentially memorializes current practice.
Yeah, it's more or less current practice. People do it, and if a person negotiates in the articles, what are you going to say? That, sorry, you negotiated, but we're not going to give it to you because the statute doesn't say so? So I don't think that,
That's what I was trying to get to. So, okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Representative, are your concerns met then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2305 and open a work session on House Bill 2305. I'd entertain a motion to move this to the floor. Do pass.
So moved.
Consent.
And we'll put it on a consent calendar. Is there any opposition to that? Everybody okay with that? Okay, it's been moved by Representative Smith. Take the roll, please.
Mr. Chair, can we hear it tomorrow?
No. It's a good point he makes.
Let's discuss this.
Let's discuss it tomorrow.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. We'll go on the consent calendar. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2316.
And the hearing is that we're
opening hearing. Mr. Willis.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Tim Willis. I'm an attorney in private practice in Corvallis. I've been down there going on 33 years. As the chief has indicated to you, I'm the chair of the Trial Court Judicial Resources Committee. You've been handed the report that our committee has prepared for you in support of how the 16. What I would do today is just take a little time and give you the background of how we've come up with our recommendations and the process that we used. In the front of the committee report, there's an executive summary that shows the members of the committee, but on page 3, it shows our recommendations to you. We're recommending 13 new judicial positions. We've also prioritized those positions so that the greatest need is at the top and working our way down 1 through 13. Now, we use a three-step process to determine our recommendations. The first is looking at the trial court filings in each of the judicial districts. And in this case, we've looked at the filings in 2005 and 2007. From that, we apply a weighted caseload analysis to the filings. And the reason we do that is that I think it's probably obvious that some types of filings take more time than others. So a small claims filing would not be rated as high as, say, a felony case filing. For those of you who really want more information than you may want, there's some appendix that are attached to the report. Appendix B and Appendix C give a little explanation of this weighted caseload study and the terminology for it. For those of you who are statistically inclined, and that's not me, Appendix D is also there, and it shows how the weight in terms of minutes are applied to the case filings in each of the 27 judicial districts. From the statistics that are gathered, we do a predicted need for each district, and that's Appendix E, and that is really the reports that I spend most of my time on and look at. There are two pages to that. The first page just goes in order of the judicial districts 1 through 27. The second page, I think, is a little more helpful. It starts at the top with the greatest need and works its way down, showing the recommendation, the need for the number of judges in each district, and then the demand of the supply percentages. So that gives us our statistical background to start our report, and we believe this is an objective review of the situation in each of the districts. From there, we send these statistics to each district and ask that if the district wants to request more judges, that they write us and then submit written information. And we direct that written information. We give them, which is in Appendix A, our suggested discussion items that we want them to respond to. And, you know, I feel this is where we put the judges through the pace, or the popular term now, we vet them a little bit, but we work them, and there are many areas that they have to provide information to us, and it ranges from basically whether the county commissioners go along with them, whether there's space for the a new judge. We basically won't promote a new judge if there's not space or the county commissioners oppose us. We look at the county commissioners as our friend, and it's very important that they work with us. We also require that they tell us about the technology, the efficiencies that are being used. We don't want to reward a district who's inefficient. But from that information, we go to step three. So the first step is the statistics. The second is the written information that's submitted to us from each district that wants a new judge. And then we hold hearings where the presiding judge or the trial court administrators can come in and provide us additional information and respond to our questions. So it's this analysis that we use to determine the need in each district. And then from that, we also prioritize the need among the districts. Brief word on the committee. The committee is a volunteer committee, although it's difficult to tell the chief no when he calls you and says he wants you to serve on this committee. But it is a volunteer committee, and if you look at the executive summary, we have members from all over the state. It's a committee that doesn't have a budget. I think it shows that we're really dedicated. We work on this. We don't get mileage. We essentially work for the coffee and pastries that we get at our meetings, which are normally on Saturday because it's a busy group. But I think we're really concerned that having an adequate judicial staff is really part of the critical infrastructure of this state, and there's some serious problems now. This is my fifth session of serving on the committee, and I really have a serious concern that there's a great disparity between the existing judicial resources and the actual documented need for more judges. And I think that problem's not only continuing, but I think it's worsening. So I would urge the committee to give serious consideration to our report.
Any questions? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I'm confused, and maybe my confusion is, I don't know, warranted. But the recommendations that you alluded to in the report, is that on page 20 of the report? Is that correct? The 13, the
ranking? Well, I used
ranking?
The page.
So where
well,
were
I
you
started
at?
On the executive summary, page 3.
Okay.
I thought that was a little clearer. It gives the districts and then our priorities on the left-hand side. And it's also included in the report itself, but it may be a little more confusing to dig into that. I know you haven't had a chance to really look at
Well, yeah,
this,
I guess, so how do you crosswalk between that and what ultimately ended up in the recommendations? Because they're different, unless I'm not reading this correctly.
No, they should be the same.
Okay, so the 13 you have listed here in your executive summary?
Somebody right.
What page number?
20.
Either 20 or the three little, the Roman numeral three. And what's in the House Bill 2316? Am I missing something?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, we have actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 judicial districts. Is it because there's
more judges? In some districts, we're recommending several judges, and it's probably a little confusing, but if you look at Multnomah County, of the 13, we're recommending.
Right, I know there are 13 here, but I counted myself,
and I thought.
How do you crosswalk between here and here? I mean.
Well, you're looking at House Bill 2316.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you kind of go down, and I count on my fingers, but you go down to see there, Marion County.
Right.
They have 14. They want 17. So there's three there. Next is Multnomah. There's 38. They want 42. There's four there.
I see how you do
that.
Okay.
And I've done
You've
that a couple
repeated,
times.
Rather than group them 13. Into a... Okay. I see it now.
Okay.
So rather than group them into a, like, three for their
well,
judicial
and
district...
Well, it's because we prioritize them
I got
differently.
You.
So
what you're... This is your ranking...
Correct.
If... Of rolling them out.
Right, and
of the 13 guess, that are recommended in the bill.
Correct.
Okay.
And
so rather than three in the third judicial district all at one time, you have one, and then later on you'd add it, okay, depending on what the financial
or whatever.
And if I may follow up, we try to live in the real world, and never has the legislature gave us every judgeship that we think there's a need for. And that's why we prioritize it, because I think it's important that we tell you where we think the greatest need is and work our way down.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Willis, in 2005, I believe there was a request for 11 new judges, as I recall.
That sounds right, yes.
And I think we gave three or four. We prioritized also, saying, hey, we can't give them everywhere. At that time, part of that need was driven by what we're seeing, some of our areas, Clatsop County, over east. It had to do with meth, and that...
It was Umatilla-Morrow was the other one. There were four judgeships that we got in 2005.
We were able to do that during what I would say fairly, well, not good times, but times when, you know, you had to prioritize. And right now, though I know there's a tremendous need, we all recognize that, and we try to deliver justice in the system, and sometimes you can't get there if you don't have the tools and the people and the staff to do it. But Mr. Chair, wouldn't this go down to Ways and Means?
Yeah,
and I can just about tell you what's going to happen, regardless of what we do. In my own opinion, we heard the Ways and Means people today about, you know, new employees, new programs, and so I'm not discouraging. I'm just saying that this is going to be a tough one to come to the top of the list, and that's you know, we've got four attorneys here. They know what justice is. They're trained to know what justice is. Police officers, three of us that have dealt with it, and. It makes it difficult.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Willis, first of all, I really like the fact that you're using, weighing the categories of cases. I wish the Human Services would look at that, because we talk about caseloads and Human Services, and they don't look at the complexity of them. My question is, you said that the counties concurred with this, but I think a key element is Representative Krieger mentioned it's going to have to go to Ways and Means, and do you have commitments from the counties for this funding for the facilities, and will they be on? Are we going to hire a judge and not have a courtroom?
No.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. I can take them one by one. For court revenue, has there been discussion within your folks or within other folks about looking at some increased fines that either just delayed, haven't been increased for a long time, and therefore are warranted? I know we've dealt with a little bit, but has there been any discussion about that? Because I have the same concern. It is very easy for us to say yes. It's much easier for us here to just say yes, because it doesn't cost us anything.
Right.
And then, but I don't know that that's fair to our colleagues, who then later on have to say no many more times because it's so easy for us to say yes. So I have a few questions around that. My first one is, has there been any discussion about looking at places where it wouldn't be too terrible to increase fines?
Unfortunately, that's not within the purview of our committee. I know the chief has talked about it, but basically his directive to us was to try to examine the need, and we've not gotten into the financial end of it at all. But I'm not saying it's not done, and I think it probably has been done somewhere else, but not by our committee.
Mr. Chair, another question?
Please.
Thank you. Another question. What, and related to this, and I hope that all of us will be thinking about how we can send overall prioritization signals to Ways and Means Committee. It is very helpful, I would say, for me to have your listing of priorities. Very helpful. And my guess is, if we send a bunch of binary signals, yes or no, to a committee that has to make priority decisions, then we haven't given regardless of what our views are on the yes or no, we haven't given very helpful information to them. If we just say, hey, here's the 37 things, we know you're going to pay for four of them, you make the decision with less information than we had as a judiciary committee. So one thing I'm partly saying this to, and partly saying this to our committee, is there some way we can think about overall prioritization signals for all of the new programs we're asked, for all the new services we're asked to fund to the Ways and Means Committee? My question for you are the following two. Are there other priorities that either your section or other folks who are allies are going to be bringing forward that we should be aware of, in addition to new judges, okay, whether it's facilities or other support staff? And second, mildly related, what efficiency measures are being undertaken to make sure that we're doing, that we're getting ever better in our ability to deliver justice and deliver access to justice with people, even in the context of a shrinking pie?
Well, let me deal with that first. And in the report, it's discussed some, but the courts go into the e-court system. They're going to different specialty courts. Even though that takes more time, it's been effective in keeping people from coming back. And I think there are some more listed in the report, but that is being addressed. And those are questions we ask. It's in our suggested discussion items. And so when we get the written materials from each district, they cover that. And the question on other priorities, there are, and I, you're going to think I'm single-minded, and I guess I am on this committee, but like the last session, you know, the priority was judicial pay. And technology was another big one, and facilities, and then new judges. You know, to me, those are typically the four priorities that the judiciary has to deal with, and I leave that up to the chief. He tells me to work on this, and that's what I do. But he's the one that would be the better person to tell you how he's looking at the priorities this time. I know he was very serious this time to get new judgeships. We received none last session, the 2007 session. As Representative Krieger said, we got four in 2005. We got none in 2003. It really concerns me. If we have none in 2007, none in 2009, we're really slipping behind. It's getting to be a bigger and bigger problem. And I've had to listen to these judges come and testify to me and you know, tell me about their workload and how they're trying to deal with things. And I see these statistics and. I mean, I'm a redneck business attorney. I'm not a trial attorney. We know whether the courthouse is open or not, I'm still busy. But it's really important to me that if a business deal breaks down or a real estate deal breaks down, that the court's there to help settle that. And, 6 years ago when the courthouse was shut one day a week, civil business cases just weren't heard at all. They didn't have the priority. And that really messed me up. You know, you can't do seller financing because the seller can't get in there to save their business. And so I'm doing this not because, I go into court and do a lot of trials, but because I think it's really important to the overall economic system of the state. So.
Us too.
Just in Multnomah County, if I was to have some kind of a civil suit, labor dispute or something, how long would it take me to get a trial date right now? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. I look back at Monty. Oh, yeah. She's not saying. So I'm sorry, Chair.
In previous times, I mean, we're in things I was involved with, we were looking at something and said, it's 2 years out, so we won't bother kind of thing, when they couldn't get in the door with some of those. One of the primary reasons I supported the tax increases back in the 2003 was because the courts were going to be closed one day, and I had some premonition of what that might look like, and it did. I mean, in Washington County, they just had to stick things in boxes and forget about them.
Yeah.
And so it's a great concern. As you've heard from people on the committee, and as you must be aware, the budget is something like has never been seen, you know, at least in my lifetime. And I don't have high hopes for being able to do much, but I think it would be good for us to send this down maybe and see if we can't get something. But I don't see anywhere near the numbers you're asking for that we'll be able to do that. But the courts, in order to deliver justice to the citizens of Oregon, we do need to have courts that can operate. So, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really do appreciate you bringing this forward and all the work that you and the committee put together on the work. I agree with Representative Barker. I think it'll be a tough road to hoe to get significant funding in there. However, in House Bill 2317, we have some options, and maybe we could come up with $374,400 if the case materialized, that we were able to recoup some more money from the lottery. But I will probably, because I'm the chair of the public safety sub, I don't want to send a particular message by voting yes for this. So I'm certainly am fine with you sending it down there. But just to let you know, my no vote is not an indication that I don't appreciate the work that you as volunteers have done. But it's just I think sending it down there is fine. But I just don't want to send the wrong message.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is more a question not for our witness here, but for you, Mr. Chair, is any way, if this does get forwarded on, to couple the prioritization list with the actual bill language? I don't know how we would do that, but I would think that would be important.
That's a good idea. Well, it'll be addressed down in Ways and Means, but it is going to be very difficult. I have a little. I mean, it just. You said it. I don't know how to say that any plainer. Yes, Representative Smith.
A comment, and I don't know if it's better, and forgive me if this is out of order. I don't know if it's better to have a comment when it's coming to the committee at this stage or when we're right about to vote. But if we could have a discussion at some point about what sort of signal we think is helpful for us to send down. I mean, I'm game to do whatever. I think I'm probably exactly where you are, that I think courts are absolutely critical, and I know everything else we're cutting. And not sure, you know, what the most sensible thing for us to do is, and not sure what, and relatively sure that a yes or no is only partly helpful. And we might think about if there's an accompanying letter or something else we can do that gives a little bit of information. I just wanted to offer that. Maybe it's a hallway conversation later, but it does seem to be a structural challenge with our process that we make these binary votes and then somebody else makes a priority decision. Right. So.
Well, and we probably will send fewer down this year than we might have in past sessions just because of that. And there will be hopefully some sort of a package at the end where we'll take a look at public safety bills, and there's going to be very few, it looks like, are going to come out of there. I mean, it's just going to be very difficult. So. With that said, no further discussion. I would accept a motion to send this to the floor.
We in a work session.
Representative Wisnant so moves.
We in a work session?
Oh, I'm sorry. We close the public hearing and open a work session. Thank you.
I so move that we pass this to Ways and Means. We do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2316 to the floor with the due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Chair.
Aye.
Oops. Chair, did you repeat a motion to the floor? Is it?
I just did say to the floor.
First time. I think you said Ways and Means.
Just for clarification, could you just repeat the
two Ways and Means,
what the motion is we're voting on?
Two Ways and
Means. Send this to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Thank you.
And thank you. Once again.
Representative Barton?
Representative Cameron was going to ask if we were going to vote tomorrow. I'm an aye vote.
Representative Cameron?
Today, yes, please.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. And next we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2317. Bruce Miller.
Person that you swear from is offended.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm a senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Thank you for taking time to hear both of our bills today. House Bill 2317 is designed to give us a tool for our collections. The way the system is meant to work is that when a lottery winner has winnings of over $600, the lottery will be able to check against a database that we put together to see if that person has a court-ordered financial obligation, such as restitution or a fine. In the event that the winner does owe such a financial obligation, then the Judicial Department would have an opportunity to begin garnishment proceedings against those winnings. This is something that the lottery already does for child support. It is similar to a concept that we had in 2007. It was actually part of a bigger bill that included a federal tax offset. because of the magnitude of the federal tax offset, that bill never got out of Ways and Means. But the other concept did not draw any opposition from lottery. They were neutral on the bill and had a modest fiscal on it. I would like to point out that there is another bill in the House, House Bill 2147, which involves a much broader attempt to capture through the lottery all obligations owed to the state. If that bill were to make its way through the body, that would include what we want to do here, and that would be the bill that we would follow. Our concern is that bill may not make it all the way through the body, so we would like this smaller concept in place so that we'll at least be able to do this system if the other bill doesn't go forward.
Okay. When we first started doing the child support, is that amount of money coming in state city, or is that dropped off? Somebody told me that we're pretty good at starting out, but now it's...
Mr. Chair, I don't know what's happened with the child support. I don't know if it's level or dropped off. I can tell you that under this bill, child support would continue first priority over any obligations that we would try to collect on.
Okay, and I'm curious. I was trying to think how somebody might get around that, and so I win the $1,000. So I say, Gene, I got this court obligation. How about taking my ticket down, cash? Are people doing that, do you think? Or,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, people are really, really clever. I'm sure that they've thought of that, but not everyone's that clever.
And what kind of cost is the mechanism to do these collections? Is that, and where does that come from?
The money would come from us. We would, from the Oregon Judicial Department, Mr. Chair, we would enter an intergovernmental agreement with Lottery. They have some first-time startup costs of I believe around $58,000. We would have some programming costs, one-time programming costs of about $50,000. And I believe Lottery has a second biennium cost of $38,000, but I haven't seen what LFO wrote up on that, so I'm not sure of all the details.
And you would be paying that, the judicial that would be collecting this would pay that for the lottery, or would the lottery pay that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon Judicial Department would pay that. I believe there are constitutional issues on lottery picking up that cost.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, you talked about how child support payments go to the front of the line in this type of circumstance. Would that also be true for child support that's collected to reimburse TANF programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I'm not sure of the answer on that. I don't think that it would make any difference. It's whatever DHS is able to go to the lottery to collect for child support, that will always be first under this scenario. But I'm not sure of all the nuances on the TANF money.
It might be something that we think about is that if we're going to do this, if the person has child support obligations to someone who's receiving welfare TANF, that basically what we're doing is we're sending the money back to the federal government. That might be second or third in line rather than first.
Any questions? Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This one,
please.
Members, for the record, my name is Larry Nicewander. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Lottery, and I appreciate the opportunity to make a few brief comments. I'm sorry I wasn't able to be in the hearing when the Chief Justice was here to make his opening comments. I was in another room, but I have a pretty good sense that it was a rare opportunity for the Chief to represent to you. He has a revenue proposal. The lottery is not taking a position on this bill. We are neutral, as has been previously indicated, and we think the proposal to collect monies due the state of Oregon is laudable. There are some complications. A couple of them have been spoken to already that may hinder this being an effective tool. And we want to just put those on the record for you. However, with the caveat, if the legislature makes the policy choice that they want the lottery to be involved in the collection of outstanding debts through its lottery winners, we'll do our best to implement it in the most streamlined, efficient, effective method we can. Right now, we have a fairly manual process with child support. It's somewhat labor-intensive, and there is some cost associated with that. And that's the legislature's policy choice. We'll do the best to implement it. It does have some trouble in terms of application, and you've actually alluded to a little bit of it. It's the sales and revenue impact. We're a sales organization, just like any business that does sales. So anything that would potentially negatively impact our ability to sell products, if it comes to, and somebody goes, well, winning is not really the same if you come in and your winnings are gone, if there's some kind of negative message there, it could have an adverse effect on state revenue collections, which has a corresponding impact on, could adversely affect the amount of revenue that the lottery transfers. Now, we do transfer, this biennium, we're on track to transfer approximately $1.3 billion. So this particular bill and its impact, we have to measure that. As was testified by the Judicial Department, the other bill is far more encompassing in terms of the number of collections that would be made against lottery winners. I think it's somewhere in the order of 1,200 claims per year. The judicial bill is a lot smaller. It's probably more in the order of magnitude of around 130 claims for collection per year. But that is one impact that we will mention on any collections effort made against a sales organization's business, which lottery believes its number one charge is to generate the maximum revenue commensurate with the public good for the state of Oregon. The second real issue is consumer avoidance actions, and you spoke to that briefly too. We do think that lottery players will quickly understand the collection mechanism and find ways around it, potentially dampening the actual long-term collections amounts available. Since all lottery prize tickets are bearer instruments, people who owe debts who will have the option of handing that to a friend or a relative to make the actual collection, and we see that happening under the current scenario with child support. There are some identification limitations within the bill, and this is just something that is the way it's set forth in federal law, and that is that we cannot use a Social Security number to cross-match and identify people who owe money for any purpose other than tax collections or child support. So we'd have to work out some mechanism whereby the people at the window voluntarily consent to have that SSN number used for other collection efforts, such as this one. So it does create a little bit of a complicator in terms of absolutely positively identifying the person for which we are collecting. Advance payment, and this was spoken to briefly too. It is constitutionally, and I gave you a copy of a DOJ's attorney opinion on the subject of what can lottery funds be used for. And essentially, it concludes that there are three constitutionally established purposes for lottery funds, this not being one of them. So we would have to be, according to the opinion, paid in advance for any actions that lottery does.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, did we get those handouts?
This is just being submitted for the record.
It's just submitted for the record. There is not enough to be.
There's enough opinions. I'm sorry. I did not get here with 25 copies of the testimony, but I will bring them to you. I did get the behind that testimony is the Attorney General opinion copies.
Okay.
Copy of the letter. Sure.
Thank you.
We have been working before this bill come before this committee with the members, representatives from the Judicial Department and representatives of Department of Administrative Services on both bills, this bill and the bill that's before the House Revenue Committee, just to understand how they work. There is some consensus around the fact that this other House bill before the Revenue Committee probably has some of these issues addressed in it. It does have a small fiscal impact. It is the first time up to upfront costs, approximately $18,000, and then the rest would be on the per collection basis where the lottery would have to recover all costs that would incur. And we've done our best to estimate those costs based on what we think the cost, the time involved, and the number of transactions. We're going to do what we can. It has to be a break-even proposition for us. We just need to make sure that we don't unlawfully divert lottery funds for the use of this collection effort. So As I mentioned in the opening comments, I think the goal of collecting to support the judicial branch government is a very laudable goal, and we look forward, we'll work to get this bill that does that for. We do have tremendous odds over the large jackpots that the state of Oregon has in its games, because it's a game of chance and for entertainment value. For Powerball, the odds of a big winner are 1 in 195 million. For Megabucks, they're 1 in 6.1 million. And for the raffle that's out there now, as you're aware, there's 1 in 250,000 chance of a winner. So there are minor odds. You know, there are other options that for collection of revenue that we hope that this body, through other committees, and with your support, could help support the revenue. There was an article last weekend in the Statesman Journal about how $1.3 million in states' tax dollars are not collected each year for a variety of reasons. I hope that would be an effort that would result in additional income. That's $2.6 billion for And we're well aware that in the liquidated and delinquent accounts receivable report that's done every biennium, the last one I saw was in June of 08, it had over $750 million in outstanding collections between Department of Revenue and Judicial Department. So there are amounts owed the state that need to be collected. This one would offset against lottery winners only. So with that, if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them.
You were saying the Social Security number can only be used for certain things. When I'm assuming that when somebody comes down and collects their over $600, that they have to submit their Social Security number for the taxes. But you still can't use that as a cross-reference? Or
even if we collect it, we cannot allow it to be used for other than the purposes that the federal law allows us to use it for, which are those two purposes, child support and taxes.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, thank you. We don't have a fiscal back, so we can't work this today. So, no further thing. Close the public hearing. All right, yeah. On House Bill 2317. We have another bill to drop. This is relating to products of individuals with disabilities and declaring an emergency. It's a committee bill, and by voting to drop this does not mean that you're in support of it. Doesn't say anything about that. Just gives authorization to get this into the system. So I would ask that somebody move that we put LC 1358, adopt LC 1358. So, Representative Garrett so moves. Is there any discussion about that at all? Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Yep. Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Carries it. We have one more item of business today. If you want to go ahead and talk about the SMS, whether we want to get those hand-delivered or emailed to us at a quicker rate. So.
Just very briefly, members of the committee, I've had a couple of requests to get the SMSs the day before so that any advanced research can be done. As you can see, there have been some complicated issues. I'd be happy to email those the night before, but I would kind of like to know who would like that and who would actually like to have hard copies, so we're not just ending up printing out paper and moving things around that the members don't actually want. So we can have our staff email them the night before, or you can continue to get the packet sitting at your chair when you come in.
I'd like them here.
Okay.
I'd like them emailed, please.
Okay. I'm just going to make a note. You can each do something. It's fine.
Yeah, whatever.
I'd like them here. I'd like Representative Barton to get his at home.
What's that?
You can get his tomorrow.
Is it either or? Could I have him email? I'd like him emailed, but I like having him here too, if that's all right.
Okay.
What would you like, Representative Barton? How would you?
If I could get one.
It's just no easy issue.
I enjoyed the day before.
Okay. Representative Siegler.
You can email them to me.
Mr. Chair, we ever went through this, we didn't have attorneys.
Yeah.
That's true. Careful.
We're actually trying to get these bills out.
I mean, things were a lot simpler.
I'll just have to remember to print the damn thing. So.
No questions for corporate bills at all.
I'll just go the other way. You know.
Mine's here.
I'll just.
Okay.
Yours here. Representative Cameron's like this.
No further business before the committee adjourned.